According to the calendar year, fall starts September 22nd and lasts through December 1st. Just a couple weeks into the fall season, the signature fall signs are starting to finally show and become more noticeable. The sun is setting sooner. You can't leave without a jacket. But there are other signs out there, too. Signs from the natural world living around us. Good morning. This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. It's the fall edition of Nature in the City. We explore the flora and fauna that cohabitate this area we call the Kansas City Metro and beyond. Our guests this morning are regular seasonal contributors, Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist at the Missouri Department of Conservation. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Suzanne.
And Joe Werner, biologist and urban ecologist. Good morning.
Good morning, Suzanne.
And then one of the best parts about Nature in the City is inviting you, the listeners, to share your nature sightings within the metro and to field your questions. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. But first, gentlemen, let's look back at this past summer, not as hot and dry as the year before. How would you describe this past summer, and how has it affected the beginning of this fall season, Larry?
Well, the most notable thing about this summer, I'll just look at the whole growing season, was it got started much, much later than last year. And I really saw that trend continue throughout the whole season as far as the blooming phenology, timing of plants and things like that. It seemed to kind of carry on throughout the whole growing season. We had ample rain early and then very droughty late, so it was kind of both ends of the spectrum there around this area.
And then how has that affected area wildlife as it's starting to transition and get cooler?
Suzanne, I think we can even look back to the summer 2012 and see some of the results in 2013. Just as an example, the amphibians. There's probably fewer amphibians that I've seen this past summer than in many, many years past. Tree frogs, for an example, you know, used to be, you know, very, very abundant. But I probably heard maybe half a dozen this year in different places around the town.
And those are the, what do they look like?
Well, it's a very small frog that actually has suction cups on its feet. People often see them on their windows if they have some nice landscaping outside and some water available. It's a pretty common urban species.
And how are we looking in terms of precipitation? Are we on track for this time of year?
I believe last time I saw we were a little behind.
Still behind, yeah.
Not by too much, but a little bit.
And you mentioned amphibians. What other species are being affected by, you know, even just the drought from two summers ago and, you know, building back up and getting us ready for fall?
Well, you could look at some of the trees, actually, that really had a difficult time in 2012, and a lot of them succumbed in the 2013, even though there was a nice spring. The stress was just too much for them.
And you may see that lingering another year, more trees dying and be attributed to 2 years ago, and a lot of people may not make that connection. Huge difference. I was just out on a prairie recently and thinking about the comparison between last year and this year. Even the tall prairie grasses, like big blue stem that commonly get 6 feet or more last year, were just very stunted, half that height in some cases. And this year they're just really going gangbusters. Yeah. They got the rain at the right time and they're really robust. So huge difference in 1 year to the next.
Are there some trees that are affected more so than others?
For sure. And in the urban area in particular, the thing we're noticing is the conifers trees, the pines and the spruces taking a hit. You see dead ones all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's just a reflection that they really don't belong around here and don't do well here. And you can get away with it for 5 years, 10 years, maybe 20 years in some cases. But then you get a year like that's known for this area and they can't handle it. There's really very few evergreen trees that do well around here.
And what should people do in that situation? I mean, should they just dig them up and replant something that's native? Or, I mean, is there a way of caring for them to help them make it through these hard times?
Well, in some cases, you can water the heck out of them, but it's really not very practical. It's just not something you should plant. When it dies, take it down and replant something better. If you want a coniferous tree, or a pseudo-coniferous tree, is bald cypress really does very well in urban landscapings. It drops its needles in the fall, so it's not green year-round. But does really well, surprisingly well, in urban areas.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned the tree frogs are having a hard time. Are there things that people can do in these situations, or is it just something that this is nature? I mean, some years are just bad for certain species.
These are just the cycles that are out there, Suzanne, that rear their heads periodically.
One thing you can do for that species, though, are the little backyard water gardens. Those mm-hmm. species, if they're around, we'll find those, yeah. And that's the problem. Last year, there weren't the little pools of water for breeding that they depend on. So we're seeing the results of that this year and less frogs. But the good thing is populations of animals like that can rebound pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I'm still seeing mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. What's that about?
Yeah.
Not happy about it.
I guess the answer with them is it just doesn't take much. Yeah. A little
right.
bit of water here and there. And
very quick reproductive cycle. Yeah.
Well, kind of getting back into the things that people can do, you were both gardeners also. What we were talking about things before the show that people can do to help the butterflies, especially the monarch butterflies, who it's been in the news, they've been having a hard year this year. Let's talk about the monarch butterflies and things that people can do to help them out.
Well, the first thing I would suggest is that people go to the Monarch Watch website that's sponsored by Dr. Chip Taylor over at KU. And there's a lot of good suggestions there, good information on not only the natural history of monarchs, but how they're doing not only in the U.S., but more importantly in their overwintering grounds down in Mexico. And butterfly gardening, well, they're even providing milkweed plants that people can plant.
There are a number of native species that do very well in a backyard setting in a sunny location. They're very showy plants. Butterfly milkweed's a really vivid orange plant, mm-hmm. Purple milkweed. They bloom at different times of the year, so you get color at different times of the year. And it's amazing how monarch butterflies, even in an urban setting, you have just a handful of those plants in your yard. They'll find them. You'll see mm-hmm. the monarch larvae, which are really easy to identify on those things.
Have you seen large monarch migrations to Missouri in the past?
Oh, for sure. Some years, yeah. Usually in September, early. I think mm-hmm. of it as early mid-September, mm-hmm. kind of a peak time around here. Oftentimes, but saw a few drifting around by in certain days this fall, but not many.
Not very abundant this year. There are some places that. For some reason, the monarchs will stop and overnight. I've seen several of them in the Kansas City area, and one that was the most spectacular for me was down on Crowley's Ridge in southeast Missouri. There were literally thousands of them down there that I just happened to hit at the right time.
Wow.
It's pretty spectacular.
And then there's another thing, Joe, that you saw flying through the air, not butterflies, but... to scare people, but I think this is amazing. Can you talk to us about the gossamer?
Well, the gossamers were out.
And gossamers are?
Well, there's just spiders trying to move from one place to another. They cast their webs out, and the wind carries them. And if you're out, last weekend was a wonderful weekend to see them. If you happen to just look up in the sky and you saw these threads of silk being carried around, that was the gossamers.
So little spiders floating through the air.
Yeah.
Which have been documented at amazing altitudes.
Yeah.
So they have a huge capability for dispersal.
Wow. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. It's the fall edition of Nature in the City. What signs of nature have you been seeing in our city? Do you have any questions about the changing season and how it affects area wildlife? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. 816-235-2888, or you can send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org, and we're also on Twitter at KCURCST. We're going to hear now from Gail in Roland Park. Gail, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You're on the air.
Uh-huh. Well, I was telling the guy, we saw a bird that was really big and had a red head and looked very weird, and it was just kind of in the yard, and then there was we noticed later that there was a dead animal nearby. We looked it up, and it's a turkey vulture, and I wondered if they were migrating through, and my friend, who also took pictures of it, of one, saw one in South Overland Park, and I'm in Roland Park, so I don't know if it was the same bird or if there's. If this is just the time of year that they're here.
Gail, you nailed it. The turkey vultures are really migrating right now. Typically, you'll see them just soaring in the air. They rarely flap their wings. But when you see one on the ground like that, you know that there's probably some dead animal that they eat. They eat carrion or dead animals that perhaps got hit by a car or had some other unfortunate thing happen to them.
It is a bird, however, that's not just a migrant. They do nest around here. They're here. You can see them in this area anytime from February into November, pretty much.
They'll even nest on rooftops of buildings.
You know, I've also seen them, Gail, I've seen them near the dog park and in places near the dump over, you can see them flying around, and they're kind of menacing looking at first at first glance. Thanks for the call, Gail.
Well, if you see one on the ground, you don't want to approach it because they have a very unique protective behavior, and that is that they will regurgitate on you.
Really?
So don't approach them.
Like, how close would you have to get, do you think?
Pretty close.
Yeah, pretty
usually
close.
Usually it happens if you disturb a nest site where they nest at the mouth of a cave or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
I've heard of cavers encountering that, and if you really think about that in detail, that's not a pleasant thought.
No.
We're going to take a call now from Shane. Shane, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Okay. Well, this is Shane from Maryville. I think you remember me probably.
Hi, Shane.
Oh, you guys went to school together, it says here?
Yes, we did. And my question was, it seems like the robins don't seem to go south anymore. They used to say robins were the first sign of spring, but I see them all winter. And second, I had a question if the emerald ash borer problem is getting any closer to being solved.
Okay.
So I'll let you go, and hope you're okay.
All right. Thanks, Shane. So let's start first with the robins.
Yeah, it's a good question. Robins are here year-round, and they always have been. It's not the same individuals, however. Robins do migrate, and like a number of other bird species that we see year-round, it's just not the same individuals here that nest here that stay here in the winter. However, the numbers of robins that winter here are much increased over previous decades, and I attribute that to really an unfortunate thing, and that's the abundance of food here, and unfortunately a lot of that is the invasive exotic shrub honeysuckle that gives them a food source year-round. So in mild winters, we can have thousands and thousands of robins here, particularly areas like along the Blue River Corridor and other parts of town. It's not uncommon to see that. And they do, more of them linger here and stay here in the winter than ever used to me.
And what can people do about those invasive honeysuckles? Just try to rip them out of their gardens?
Kill them.
Kill them.
I actually work very closely with a nonprofit here in town called Kansas City Wildlands, as does Joe. And we use volunteers to kill and clear out honeysuckle on areas around town, some of our better quality natural communities. And it's one of the major activities that Wildlands does, unfortunately, is combat that plant.
And then to get to his second concern or question about the emerald ash borer, and let's review kind of what that is and where we are with that.
Well, emerald ash borer is an exotic insect that's targeting ash trees in different parts of the country and really with devastating results. It's pretty much eliminated them from the landscape in areas where it's become a serious problem, like up in Michigan is where I'm familiar with it.
And we have a lot in Missouri, correct?
We have a lot of ash trees,
yes,
yeah.
A lot of native ash.
Mainly two species, but and the emerald ash borer has been found in Clay County and Platte County. I know in Platte County. I'm not sure about Clay. Here locally. Trying to contain the population. I'm not a forester. They can speak to it in a lot more detail than I can, but they're trying to do their best to contain it and quarantine those areas. Realistically, the prognosis is probably not good. It's very difficult to keep that thing in one place.
Ash trees are a very important part of our urban forest here. They're used as a landscaping tree
very
quite
much
often.
So.
Yeah.
Well, can you describe what they look like?
They're a little green bug,
yeah.
Little green beetle. One of the best things you can, I'm certain, find pictures of it on the Department of Conservation's website if you look for EAB or Emerald Ash Borer, and it can tell you what you can do if you believe you have a tree infested with it, too. There are some steps you can take, but it's not easy.
That's Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, and Joe Werner, biologist and urban ecologist. This is Nature in the City on Central Standard on KCUR. We're going to hear now from Claudia about some woodpeckers or lack thereof.
Hello?
Claudia.
Hi. What I'm wondering is there seems to be an absence of the variety of birds around here. I do hear blue jays. Normally we have lots of sparrows and house finches, and there's almost no activity at our feeders, and it seems as though they've gone away. The birds that are usually here, even all through the winter, we're not seeing them.
And you're close to Kearney, that's right?
Yes.
Gentlemen?
Well, it's not an easy question to answer, but it's something I hear from people pretty routinely. Where are all the birds gone? I'm not seeing birds in my area. And there are a lot of potential explanations, but really I think the best one right now is that they just aren't motivated to head for feeders yet. There's so much natural food out there. We haven't had hard frost. The weather's not hard. They're not stressed. So I would just give it time.
I think that there's a tendency for people to take down trees that may be dead or decaying, even if they don't present some sort of a problem. And that's a good nesting site for woodpeckers. They're cavity nesters, and they get into trees that are dying and where limbs have fallen off and all. So if it's safe to leave something like that, that would help encourage the woodpeckers to nest more in the area.
We had a whole stand of evergreens that we cut down and burned because of it's something peculiar to evergreens that's killing them.
It can be a number of things with evergreen. As we were saying earlier, they're just not well adapted here. So there are various insects, fungus infections, all kinds of things that they're prone to. So,
all right, Claudia, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
So talking more about birds, there's a lot of birds that we don't see as much. She was saying that it may not be time to be seeing some of these birds, but there are a lot of birds that live here year-round that we just don't see as much. Larry, you were talking about that a little bit before the show. Can you kind of recap some of those and ways that we can try to find them?
Which ones were we referring to?
Oh, you were saying that there's birds that we don't see as much. There's a lot of that are coming together and starting to starting their flocks going through Missouri or, you know, making their ways around. And then there's the ones that live here year-round that we don't see as much.
Well, just as an example, the crows are starting to flock up right now, and I'm sure that people in the heart of the urban area here will be seeing some of these large crow roosts as they move from place to place around town, usually in the midtown areas where we hear about them. One example.
What about blue jays and sparrows, some of these other birds? What are they up to right now?
Well, blue jays are one of those examples we'd mentioned before the show of birds that like the robins that we just talked about, are here year-round, but a lot of people, because of that, don't realize that they do migrate. And they're doing that right now. And in fact, blue jays are kind of interesting because they're a daytime migrant. Most songbirds migrate at nighttime. But if you're out in the countryside, you can see small groups of blue jays kind of hopscotching across from treetop to treetop at fairly low heights. And those are migrating groups of blue jays. So a lot of folks don't realize that bird does migrate.
Mm-hmm. And where are good places to do some urban bird watching?
Well, some of the more popular spots are probably close to water sources because it tends to give you the greatest variety of birds. So any of the area lakes are good. Longview and Jacomo, for instance. Shawnee Mission Park, I know, is a popular Wyandotte County lake on the Kansas side of it. Have been popular places for birding. Just depends what you're after, of course, habitat-wise, where you would want to go look.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a call now from Charlie. Charlie in Brookside, welcome to Central Standard.
Related to the topic you brought up earlier about the monarchs and milkweed in particular, I believe, I am ignorant about this, but I'm assuming the little yellowish-orange spots that we see on the milkweed is the larva you were talking about.
Is the what? What's that, Charlie?
The larvae.
Oh, the larva.
Yeah, that you were talking about of the monarch on the milkweed. Is that not the yellow, little yellow road spots we're seeing?
If best thing for you to do, Charlie, would be to look it up online. You can see a picture of them. They're very distinctive. They have stripes. They have black and yellow stripes on them. They're very distinctive looking if you see a monarch larva. If you're very fortunate, you see the monarch chrysalis. If you've never seen one of those, it's a spectacular thing.
And are they, if they're, my concern was if they're on the larvae, typically with milkweed, you tend to pull them off of the fences and such. At the end of the summer, is that, are they still there, and are you destroying them?
Are you referring to milkweed vines?
Yes.
Yeah, we do have a local milkweed vine that's kind of a heart-shaped leaf that climbs on fences and stuff and can get to be kind of a problem, kind of aggressive. And monarchs will use that. So, yeah, I would leave that until, you know, well, after you get a first frost, you can take it down. You're not harming them. They're not using it at that time. But that's a good point.
Charlie, thanks for the call.
All right.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. It's the fall edition of Nature in the City. One thing that I've been seeing a lot of recently are slugs on the sidewalks. A lot of them, really big, colorful ones, some that I've never, ever seen before. And it just kind of brought up some curiosities about what how do they feed, what are they, and I mean, I'm not a fan of them, just curious about them. What are they eating, and uh-huh. And what is a slug?
Well, they are what they are, so you know, they're slugs. No, but they you know, they'll eat vegetation. Some people try to keep them out of their gardens because they can devastate some of the plants in their gardens. You see a lot of millipedes moving around right now also. There's just a lot of insects out there in addition to things like slugs that are starting to move. Woolly bear caterpillars, which of course predict the winter, right?
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's an old wives' tale that I suppose the more brown that there is on the woolly bear caterpillar, which is the larva, it's a caterpillar of the Isabella tiger.
Isabella moth, yeah.
Isabella moth, yeah. The more brown on it, the more mild the winter is supposed to be.
Wow.
And they move around. I think it's more of a result of the previous spring, how early it was. That's what I've read.
Huh. So do we have a lot of slugs in the Kansas City area? Is this... Larry,
I can't speak to our slug population versus other cities, Suzanne.
Yeah.
It seems like it's been. Seems to me like it's been an especially good time of year for them.
I would suspect, you know, when it's moister out or rainier periods, you tend to have more and see more. I used to feed them to my box turtles. I used to keep box turtles, which we don't recommend as pets, but I did when I was a kid. And we have two species in Missouri, and I can tell you one species will eat them, and the other won't touch them.
Hmm.
So that's one of the extents of what I can tell you about slugs.
We're going to hear now from George in Westwood. George, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. I've got a red-tailed hawk nest in my backyard. I've got a large oak tree. And they go after my little dog. So it's a magnificent bird, but I don't think it's compatible with my dog. So I'm wondering if there's a way of preventing that from nesting again for next spring.
What exactly, when you say going up to your dog, what have you witnessed, and what kind of dog do you have, and how big is it?
I've got a little black schnauzer. He's probably about 22 pounds.
Way too big for a red-tailed hawk to mess with.
Oh, really?
Now, they may harass him, but that's
I've seen that hawk go down and swoosh down, and it's an impressive sight because the wingspan is, you know, pretty big. But
what time of year did you see that happen, George?
That happened probably in April or
spring. It's when they got young in the nest. So he's just regarding your dog as a potential predator of the nestlings and being territorial there. But I really wouldn't worry about it too much. If you had a miniature something, perhaps.
Do you own a smaller dog, should you be a little more concerned about having it around a bird like that?
Well, a red-tailed hawk would regard something as a prey item if it were, you know, but we're talking something I'm just 3 pounds, I'd say, yeah. or less,
something
like
the size
that.
Of a squirrel.
Yeah, rabbit. Rabbit is an adult rabbit, cottontail rabbit. It's about the extent of what a red-tail hawk's going to tackle.
So you're saying that George should probably leave his nest alone?
Yeah. I mean, if it hasn't actually harmed the dog, it's just kind of hazing the dog or trying to make it give it some room at certain times of year, it will probably come back and use that same nest site again. But if that's the extent of it, I don't think I'd worry about it too much.
Okay. I mean, my dog's got a lot of alpha in him, and it looks like those hawks have got, you know, the similar trait. And so those two guys, you know, every now and then kind of playing around is not going to – it's not an issue.
So just the hawk comes down, just kind of flies at the dog, or what happens?
I mean, he swooshes down, makes a whole lot of noise, and I could see his talons or whatever he has on, you know, his claws, and try to get at my dog. And he goes right down to him, and my dog just snaps right back at him, tries to get back up to him, but If no harm's going to come to the dog, then I don't have a problem. But I don't see the hawk, you know, kind of fly away with the dog. But
right,
you don't want it to escalate either, though.
If it hasn't harmed the dog yet, I don't think you have anything to worry about. And that dog's big enough. That red-tailed hawk probably really doesn't want to mess with it. Yeah. It's trying to, again, scare it off a little bit.
Okay, great.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, guys.
We have an email from Ellen. She wrote us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We live in a relatively new subdivision in Kansas City, just east of Raytown, with woods and fields around. That means we have a lot of wildlife, especially deer and turkey. One of our neighbors reports watching a bobcat take down a fawn in his yard last month. Bobcats just east of Raytown? We have a lot of bobcats in this area?
We actually do. A lot of people wouldn't realize that. They're very secretive animals, but yes, they're around anywhere you have undeveloped areas or wooded corridors. They can be there. That's quite a thing to see in an urban, in a backyard setting to witness.
It's incredible. Is there any ways to, I mean, you definitely don't want to step on their toes, but you also want to protect yourself. I mean, I assume the bobcat doesn't want to mess with a human.
They don't attack people. And actually, you know, in the scheme of things, it's doing us a service there because we have too many deer around. So it's one of the few natural predators we do have around here. Unfortunately, the most urban deer, unless they're in one of the areas where archery hunting is allowed, they're only going to die too often by diseases or being hit by cars. So, you know, that's actually a good thing, the way I look at it, that there are natural predators around.
Well, and the deer population is suffering from the chronic wasting disease. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on that's with the deers in our area?
Well, chronic wasting disease is a very specific disease. It's only been found in one area of the state. We hope it's contained there. Time will tell whether it is or isn't. But there are more widespread and more common diseases that affect deer periodically, like hemorrhagic virus, which we had a big outbreak of last year. It tends to occur in drought years a lot. So those kinds of diseases are more serious, and they really did knock back the deer population in a lot of parts of the state pretty severely.
And with the deer hunting season, you know, in the midst of it right now, what is the Missouri Department of Conservation doing to educate hunters about these diseases and ways that they can hunt safely?
Well, a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. It's that you could have a whole show on this topic, but again, I'd ask people to visit our website, and there is a lot of information about deer diseases and population management there. Chronic wasting disease is really not something we regard as a widespread problem in this state yet. We hope it never is, but there are a lot of states that deal with it and have had it for a long time. There's a lot that's not understood about that disease, but basically, there's no reason to fear it as far as human contamination yet that we know of.
We're going to take a break. We're talking with Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, and Joe Werner, biologist and urban ecologist. We'd like to hear from you. You can give us a call at 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. It's the fall edition of Nature in the City. We're inviting you to join the conversation with your nature sightings and questions at 816-235-2888. 888. I'm joined by Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist with Missouri Department of Conservation, and Joe Werner, biologist and urban ecologist, our seasonal regular guests here on Nature in the City. And let's talk a little bit about the peregrine falcon nests. Larry Rizzo, this is a project that you guys started a while back. Set this up for us and give us an update on how they're doing.
Well, peregrine falcons, until recent years, were a federally endangered species, so a lot of cities had projects where they introduced peregrine falcons in what's called a hacking program, where they basically get them accustomed to using urban habitats, which are tend to be skyscrapers that mimics their natural habitat of cliffs and things like that. And it was very successful around here, and last year, we actually had 5 active nests around the area, which I believe is an all-time high for us. Mm-hmm. 3 of them are on KCPNL at power plants on the big towers up at Iatan and Hawthorne and the Sibley plant. We had active nests. There's been one downtown at 9th and Main for many, many years. And we also have one active on the plaza. And so we're actually looking for new potential sites. We put up boxes for them. It's kind of just like it sounds, but it's open on one side, and they take to those. It seems pretty readily where we put them up. They've taken to them, and we recently placed one on top of the press box out at Arrowhead Stadium, and we put it there this time of year. The thought is that the falcons might spot it or key into it in their fall migration, come back and use it in the spring, but. Time will tell whether that one proves successful or not, but we hope so. We'll give
it's
an update
well
next
for the
spring.
Chiefs so far. And so how are you guys monitoring them? Is there a camera on them? Or
We have cameras on the one downtown, and I believe they might have one on one of the power plants too. We had a link to that. We can update that next spring when it's nesting time and tell people how to link in and watch that. There won't be anything to see there now. Should we attract one at Arrowhead, it's pretty well set up for that potential. So that may come about out there, too, if we get birds. So giving everyone an update on that next spring.
Great. Joe Werner?
Suzanne, it is interesting to see an endangered species that is recovering in an urban area. And that's been the story of the peregrine falcon for the last 20 years. And one of the primary reasons is that the nesting, you know, they're a cliff nester, as Larry described. They're up on high places and cliffs typically, but in the urban area, you know, they're overlooking the Missouri River as an example where there's good hunting. But the predation on the young is a lot less in the city than it is out in the wilds in the countryside. And that's one of the reasons that they've been so successful here.
They're almost more protected here.
Right.
The Missouri Conservation Department and Commerce Bank sponsored the peregrine release in the early 90s and has just done very well. They've not only nested here in the Kansas City area, but in Omaha, Des Moines, and these birds from Kansas City have gone all over the Midwest.
It's kind of interesting, we're talking about migration, that when those birds migrate, and they're potentially long-distance migrants, can go to South America, but these urban release birds seem to tend to stay in urban areas, that they will migrate. You know, we may get birds from Minneapolis, you know, the Twin Cities area, come down here and spend the winter, and our urban birds go to other cities to spend the winter.
The city birds, kind of like the city lifestyle.
Yeah.
Well, it's still pretty green outside as well. I mean, it definitely is starting to feel like fall in a lot of ways, but it's still so green, and you're starting to see some leaves fall. But what will cause the real color change, and then where are some really great places to see those Missouri fall colors? Joe?
Oh, boy. Well, as you said, Suzanne, right now ash trees are starting to change, and as we were talking about earlier, it's an urban landscape tree. They'll turn a little bit deeper purple and all. The dogwoods are starting to change. There's some vines like Virginia creeper that as you're driving down the highways, you see some vine trailing up the trees. It's very red right now. So the change is underway right now. Maples are starting to change. There's some wonderful trips throughout Missouri where people can go to see the color change, the fall color change, and the Missouri Conservation Department publicizes some of those on their website.
Right. There's a lot to the physiology of the color change that I can't explain very well, but one of the things that sets it off are when you have these, the best colors come from warm days, Indian summer conditions, and cool nights, mm-hmm. and seems like we're getting kind of those conditions. We had some moisture at the right time, so I'm hoping it's a really nice, colorful fall.
It's upon us.
Here in town, just to name a couple places or locally, we always recommend Maple Woods Conservation Area up in Gladstone. As the name implies, it's got lots of maples, so it tends to be real showy up there. It's a very popular place for people to go. And the drive up around Weston along the Missouri River is a really good one, up around Iatan.
Great suggestions. We're going to take a call now from Jan. She called 816-235-2888. Jan, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi there. Yeah, this summer, of course, by the time after I'd seen this little amphibian, by the time I went back down to my garden area with a camera, you know, I didn't ever find it again. But I saw a green tree frog, and there wasn't anything else like it. I mean, it's very, very green, and it has the stripe down from the mouth along the side that's kind of yellow-brown color, the big dark eye, and it was on a plant, a tomato plant, down in my little garden area behind the house, which we are. It's sort of dampish down there, and then we had, you know, watered regularly through the dry part. But this was maybe in July. It was about 2 inches long. When I looked it up in the Missouri Amphibians and Reptiles, it just shows its range as being down in the southeast corner, pretty much, and then one county in the center around the lake, I think around Lake of the Ozarks. But this is an old book, so I'm curious if green tree frogs have been sighted, you know, seen up here, and is there range spreading, or was this a really, really unusual thing?
Thanks for the question, Jan.
Jan, you actually saw a gray tree frog, believe it or not. Green tree frog is the name of a species that's found in the boot heel. We have the gray two species of gray tree frog here, and they can be bright, vivid green. They come in two color phases. So you saw
they don't
a
show that in the book or talk about it.
I'm sorry.
In the book, they don't show that or talk about it.
If you look on our website, the Department of Conservation, you probably find pictures of them. But gray tree frog can be very bright green. It's really kind of misleading.
Also with that stripe along the mouth area, or you know, getting back, that's kind of light tan coloredish like. Can they have that too? Because this one did have.
Yeah, you're describing the green tree frog there more, but that frog just will not occur here unless someone has transported it, and you noticed a population around Lake of the Ozarks. That's what's occurred there. People pick them up in the pet trade and just to keep them, and they turn them loose, and it can happen.
Well, that would be unlikely on the road that we're on.
But I'm gonna tell you, Jan, the habitat here does not support that frog. It's a boot heel swamp creature.
Yeah.
All right,
so
Jan, thanks.
So there is a green form. That's interesting.
You got a green gray tree frog.
Green gray. Just, you know.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. We're going to take a call now from Bernard. Bernard, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question has to do with bats. I have, I believe they're large brown bats is what they're called. But at any rate, they live, I think, in my house in the space between the interior wall and the exterior wall. I think I know where they get in, but I'm not positive. I know they can get in very small, just like a mouse can get through very small openings. I don't want to kill them. I just want them to move. It's been a while since one has gotten in the house, but every once in a while they do get in here. I don't know. I think my chimney is good. They're not coming through there. I think they're working their way in other crevices, you know, again, inside my old house. Do they migrate and they aren't here during the winter, and that's the time to hit any place where you think they might be getting in, and then when they come back, they'll find some other place to live?
Well, Bernard, I think you're right. What you're seeing is probably the big brown bat, which is the largest bat in the area here and one of the most common ones in the city. And as you say, they do get into houses, structures, in the smallest of cracks. They will spend the winter here. They're not a true hibernator because they will wake up on warm days in the winter and fly around and try to catch insects. So they're probably going to be there year-round. And as far as getting rid of them, I suppose the best thing to do would talk to some sort of a pet exterminator or animal exterminator that could come out and perhaps find out where they're at, how they're getting in your house, and give you some ideas on how to get rid of them, and then seal up those cracks that they're using to access the walls.
And probably a good time to do that right away, wouldn't
right
you say,
Joe?
Yeah.
Because it could turn into a bigger problem.
Probably a good thing to do right away to make sure they don't try to set up housekeeping there through the winter months.
Yeah, they will start overwintering right now.
Bernard, thanks for the call. We have an email here from Jim in Brookside. He writes us at centralstandard@kcur.org. A few weeks ago on my pre-dawn walk by St. Teresa's School at 57th and Main, I was surprised to see a fox. He was completely disinterested in me, crossed the street within 50 feet of me, and didn't even give me a look.
Again, they're one of the common predators that are in the city. Most people don't recognize them as foxes, but they're around Loose Park, or as Larry was saying earlier, the wildlife corridors along streams, wooded corridors along streams,
large cemeteries along Brush Creek right here in the plaza.
Mm-hmm.
They'll live in drainages and all kinds of places. They're really very adaptable.
And to his point of not being interested in him, is that normal? They kind of just mind
their own?
They
get used to people.
Yeah.
They live in the city, so they get used to people. And I bet they know every backyard where someone leaves the cat food out.
Exactly.
We're going to take a call from Liz, 816-235-2888. Liz in Olathe, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you. Hey, Joe and Larry, I've seen quite a few coyotes this year. And I have a medium-sized dog, and I usually put her out at 10 o'clock at night. And she just flips out when they start to howl, because there's some green lands down the street and some small lakes around here. And I've seen them even at night when I'm driving across the railroad tracks. They'll run across, into the wooded areas. It just seems like there's quite a few this year.
Well, this is the time of the year that the coyotes are very, very active. The young are still with the adults. They're moving around quite a bit. And they are very, very vocal this time of the year.
Yeah, I've heard them.
Liz, we had a coyote appear on the security camera at the Discovery Center facility right across the street from where we're speaking. So they're in surprisingly urbanized areas. I would be cautious if your dog's under 30 pounds, letting him out at night. If they're that close around, I would be very. I would supervise him when you let him out.
Oh yeah, I always let her out the front yard because I've had knee surgery, so I don't want her going very far. So I let her out and she comes back in. But she's like a 50-pound dog.
Okay, you don't have anything to worry about.
Very nervous. Her ears go up. Her tail goes up. She like heads right back inside.
There's kind of a natural kind of a competition, I think, between dogs and coyotes. They like to counter bark and howl at one another. And if you hear out in rural areas, the coyotes start howling. They stir up every dog within earshot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. But if it's less than 30 pounds, then definitely keep
I would be
distance.
Careful there. They can prey on small pets.
Well, and my neighbor's got chihuahuas next door, so she always, takes them right in.
Right.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, and as I say, they're running in packs right now, and they can draw a dog out away from a house, and the pack can attack it. So I'd be very careful.
Be careful.
Yep.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. It's the fall edition of Nature in the City. We're taking your calls at 816-235-2888. Joined by Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist, and Joe Warner, biologist and urban ecologist. Larry?
Suzanne, I just wanted to mention one thing that just occurred to me regarding the call we had from Jan about the possible green tree frog that it's really not as unusual as you might think for reptiles and amphibians to be transported and show up in places they don't belong. Just this a couple months ago, we had a horned lizard appear in Brookside.
What's a horned lizard?
Horned toad, horned lizard. Okay. It's a lizard, the little thorny looking lizards, a little flat. They're kind of flattened. They're kind of in desert and very dry areas. Used to be sold in the pet trade a lot, and they're still popular as pets. And that animal did not naturally occur in Brookside. So obviously someone had brought it there, but no explanation of how that thing got where it was found. So
and what became of it?
It does happen. I can't remember what we did with it. We transported it somewhere. It's going to be kept in captivity. It can't be. You can't release it at this point.
So he's all right.
Don't know where it came from. Yeah, he's fine.
Okay.
Well, and then you have some animals that from the desert Southwest that are moving into the Midwest, like the armadillo. And with a mild winter, they can survive the winter, and they're in the Kansas City area.
Wow, you've seen armadillos around here,
right?
Wow. We have an email from John in Lawrence, Kansas. The first sign of fall I always see is the flock of birds flying around. As far as I can tell, all the birds look the same. We used to just call them blackbirds. Are all the birds in a single group all the same species, or do they mingle? It just seems like the flocks are too big to consist of only one species.
And you're right, John. Yeah. Those big blackbird flocks, and they roost together at night, are generally composed of multiple species. Red-winged blackbirds, they can have grackles in them. They can have rusty blackbirds, mm-hmm. which is a rare species. What else? Probably even cowbirds, starlings in some cases.
Exactly.
But you can have three, four, five different species sometimes.
And there are literally hundreds of millions of blackbirds that migrate through the Midwest every year.
Right.
And they all get along fine with each other and communicate with each other.
Apparently. Oh, sure. Yeah, they roost together. I mean, it benefits, if they're different species, it's mutually beneficial. They roost in these big flocks and tends to be more protection from predators that
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
We're going to hear from Steve and Lee Summit. Steve, welcome to Central Standard.
Morning, and I had a question about birds of prey. I've been seeing a lot more of the sharp-shinned hawks and even a couple Cooper hawks. We had a sharp-shinned hanging around a neighbor's bird feeder. And came over and enjoyed a nice dove in our backyard. But I was wondering if there's a way to attract those birds the way you're doing with the peregrines.
So you like these birds around.
Yeah, I'm a former falconer.
I like to hear that, Steve, because I tend to get calls just the opposite. Someone's seen one cardinal captured by a Cooper's hawk and is very upset about it. But, of course, that's a natural occurrence. The sharp shins are migrating through about now. It's really the Coopers we have more of in and around the city because they nest here and becoming more and more common. If you want them around, feed songbirds.
There you go.
And you'll set up a bird feeder, huh?
That's right. It's called feeding birds with birds.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear they're on their increase. Thank you.
Thanks. And before we run out of time, I wanted to get to the hummingbird feeders. Larry, we were talking about that a little before the show. A lot of people put their hummingbird feeders away.
Right.
But you say don't do that.
Yeah, we like to urge people to keep a hummingbird feeder out. We get the ruby-throated hummingbird is the one that people attract to feeders. By this point in the year, they're pretty much gone from our part of the state, or if they're not, they will be any day. But if you keep a feeder out, you have a small chance of attracting a rarer western species of hummingbird through here, like the rufous hummingbird. They migrate as late as December in some cases. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't hurt anything. So if you're so inclined, keep it out till at least Thanksgiving or so and keep your eyes open.
No harm in keeping them up.
Right. And we like to get those reports if someone does have a hummingbird any time from late October on.
We're going to hear from Paige. Good morning, Paige.
Good morning. Hi, I'm enjoying your show. I have a question. I'm out here actually by Powell Gardens. We just moved in, and this year we believe we have several trees around us that might be an elm variant, and they have these bulbous things on the leaves that have made them turn very quickly unless they're unsightly. And I was wondering what kind of disease that might be and if it's going to kill the tree, and if so, is there anything I could do to either prevent it or help it not happen again?
Paige, are these oak trees that you're seeing these structures on the leaves?
I believe they're, what I was told was they might be some kind of elm variant.
Okay. Elm.
Well, on hackberries,
hackberry, that was what I heard.
Okay, yeah, there's some insects that lay their eggs on the leaves and cause the leaf to make a structure that, you know, that supports the egg.
So it could be an insect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's caused by an insect. You say it's pretty common on hackberries. They call them nipple galls.
Yeah.
Really nothing to be concerned about.
No.
It's important to remember if you've got problems or you think you have problems with the foliage on a tree this time of year, tree's just about to enter dormancy. So if it's losing its leaves a little early in the fall, it doesn't hurt them at all.
And wasps will lay their eggs on some oak leaves, which is why I was asking about the species of trees. And they'll have a little larger structure, larger than the nipple gall.
That's Joe Warner, biologist and urban ecologist, and Larry Rizzo, natural history biologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this morning. This is a fun edition of Nature in the City Fall.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thanks,
Suzanne. It's great to be here.
Until the winter time. Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard and a look at crime in Kansas City and police accountability. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and myself with help from Sydney Llewellyn. Up to Date is next with parents, teens, and divorce. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard on KCUR.